This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
The bottom of the hour has come and gone. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, he covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. We're pleased to be joined by Sam Werner. Sam, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to join you guys. I'm a little surprised, I got to say. People are up and functioning in Winnipeg this morning after the party that you guys had going on there last night.
That assumes that they actually have fallen asleep. They might just be going on. They might be pulling a real marathon stretch.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
Yeah. Sam, I got to say that from my perspective, I'm surprised that the people in Pittsburgh weren't able to have that similar celebration, obviously maybe not to the same extent that they did here in Winnipeg. I thought coming home game five, I didn't think the Flyers had really shown that they had much left in the tank, yet lo and behold, the Penguins lose 4-2 on home ice to the Flyers last night. How surprised were you with the performance of the Philadelphia Flyers and the Penguins?
Yeah, I was really surprised. Honestly, more so from the Flyers than the Penguins' perspective. I thought, just watching game four in Philadelphia this week, it looked like the Flyers were sort of ready to hit the golf course at that point. You know, I didn't see anything after like the first period of game three when they really put a bunch of sustained pressure on the Penguins. Everything after that point just indicated that they had no interest in sort of continuing the series. But then they come out in game five. I sort of wonder how much the change in net and putting Neuvirth in net sort of energize them a little bit, and obviously having their backs against the wall too. But the Flyers, I think, played by far their best game of the series last night. And the Penguins, you know, I think you could say it was probably their worst game of the series, but that's a pretty high bar that they had set for themselves. They'd been pretty good. I think, if the Flyers hadn't shown up the way they did, the Penguins played probably well enough to win, you could argue, last night. But, the Flyers made it clear they didn't want their series to end, and it was definitely the most evenly played game we've seen this series, and for that reason, we're going back to Philadelphia for Game 6 tomorrow.
Sam, Patrick Hornquist has missed Games 3 and 4 with that upper body injury, and we know how effective he's been on the power play for the Penguins this year and in previous years. What have you thought of Dominic Simone there on the top line? What have you thought of Jake Guentzel on that first power play unit?
Yeah, I think Simone has been pretty good on Crosby's top line. He looked a little like he had some deer in the headlights in game four when he first got in there, but I thought he settled in pretty nicely. He had a great feat to set up Jake Guentzel's goal last night, just a nifty little between the legs pass near the blue line to send in Crosby and Guentzel. And I think he sort of fit in well. I think the bigger concern with Hornquist is on the power play. And obviously the power play goes 0-for-5 last night. And allows the sort of game-changing shorthanded goal there late in the second. And, the one sort of common theme when you talk to Penguins players and coaches afterwards was they said that they weren't moving enough, which, okay, that is certainly the case, but then also that they weren't creating shooting lanes and getting the puck to the net. And that's something that Hornquist really specializes in, just sort of being that bull in a china shop in front of the goalie and making things difficult. And Guentzel, can do that to an extent. He's really good with his stick around the net, but he's just not the same physical presence that Hornquist is. And I think a lot of people were sort of quick to say, oh, okay, the power play is fine because they scored in their first attempt without Hornquist in game four. But since then, I looked up the numbers last night. I believe, I don't have them in front of me, but I believe it's 0-for-8 with 7 shots since that first attempt in game four the other night. So I think they're really missing Hornquist. The Penguins are set to practice here in about half an hour, and so we'll see if he joins them and if there's a possibility he could play in game six. But they really, really could use him, particularly on the power play.
Well, Sam, that continues on in the injury phrase. How concerned are they about Evgeny Malkin after he got fallen on in the corners there and was a little wonky in the middle frame for the Penguins?
Yeah, you saw that hit, and then obviously he leaves, and he didn't totally look right coming back. And looking at the ice time, it looked like the Penguins were sort of protecting him. He had the lowest ice time of any center in the second period there, and it looked like they were sort of saving him for power play opportunities and offensive zone time. But, once again, we'll see at practice. Mike Sullivan said after the game that Malkin was fine, but, obviously it wouldn't be unheard of for a guy to be fine and then take some time off the next day. So honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Malkin gets a maintenance day at practice today, and then we're sort of on Malkin watch again for game six tomorrow. But all indications are that he'll be good to go for game six.
Sam Werner of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're discussing the Flyers-Penguins series, the Flyers winning Game 5 last night in Pittsburgh to send it to a Game 6 Sunday afternoon back in Philadelphia. Sam, from the Flyers' perspective, Ivan Provorov, 30 minutes of ice time last night, which is an incredible number, even in the playoffs, for a non-overtime game. Just a comment, if you will, on the play of Ivan Provorov this series for the Philadelphia Flyers.
Yeah, he's really been one of the few bright spots for them, I thought, at least up until Game 5. You know, you look at the numbers of their other sort of superstars, and up until last night, Claude Giroux, Shane Gostisbehere, and you know, obviously Sean Couturier dealing with the injury, but up until the last game, the players that got the Flyers to this point really hadn't showed up for them, except I would say for Provorov. He's been pretty consistent this whole series, and really pretty impressive, and I think he's sort of the one bright spot for them. If you know, if they do in fact go on to lose tomorrow in Game 6, you can sort of say he made the most of this opportunity, where some of the other Flyers stars maybe haven't, at least up until, like I said, you know, Giroux, Couturier, and even Gostisbehere, I thought, had a pretty good game last night after a pretty disappointing first four games of this series. So, yeah, you know, Provorov, I think the name of the game for him so far this series has been consistency, especially relative to some of his teammates' performances.
Sam, we know how deep the Pittsburgh Penguins are, especially up the middle. You've got Riley Sheahan centering that fourth line. Wanted to ask you about Zach Aston-Reese. This is his first NHL playoff experience. He spent most of this year in the American Hockey League. How do you think he's done so far, five games in this first round series?
Yeah, I think he's looked pretty good. I think the fourth line in general, you know, him with Shane and Tom Kunackel on the other side, are starting to sort of forge an identity, and that's been an issue for the Penguins for a lot of the season. You know, you go back the last couple of years when they had Matt Cullen centering that fourth line, and that fourth line had a pretty clear identity of what they were trying to do. And the fourth line, obviously, with the move to Kepler Sard and shifting Sheahan down, it's been a little bit in flux this year, and so it's taken some time. But I think Aston-Reese has really fit in nicely. You know, he's a big physical player. He's got some good stick handling ability for his size. He can move for his size, and he's not afraid to throw his weight around. So, you know, they've always sort of seen him as a Hornquist prototype almost. And there was some talk for a while that, you know, he might be the guy to replace Hornquist at sort of that net front role moving forward. Now, obviously, they locked up Hornquist to an extension, so that won't happen for a while now. But they really like what they see in him, and you can sort of see it. I think he spent some time with Crosby earlier this year and put up some points, but you know, now on the fourth line, he's been really good at sort of being that momentum shifter that they're looking for out of that unit.
Sam, Sidney Crosby passed a guy named Mario Lemieux to become the all-time Penguins points leader. Just how significant was the milestone for Sidney Crosby to achieve, and how did he react to it? I know a lot of players have a tendency to kind of not want to talk about individual success, but how did he, you know, recognize that achievement?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of typical Crosby. He was really quick to downplay it, and you know, he even joked that Mario told him afterwards, "What took you so long?" And you know, if you look at the numbers, Mario did it in a lot fewer games than Crosby did. But at the same time, you know, Crosby even admitted, and his teammates and Mike Sullivan said, "Anytime you pass Mario Lemieux for anything, for any sort of record, that's a pretty significant moment." And it's hard not to see the significance there. And a guy that just meant so much to this franchise, and you know, obviously saved the Penguins on numerous occasions in Mario, and so just sort of having his name up there and having his name in that conversation speaks to what Crosby's been able to do in his time here in Pittsburgh, and just sort of what he has meant to this franchise over the last couple of, I mean, I guess almost a dozen years here now.
Sam, you know, you just mentioned Sidney Crosby, and I wanted to ask you about the rivalry between Crosby and Giroux. We know that it goes back many years, and obviously Giroux's not playing at center anymore. He's playing wing on that top line with Sean Couturier. But do you get the sense that, you know, these two players really don't like each other as much as they haven't in previous years?
You know, it's sort of been weird this whole series talking about the Penguins-Flyers rivalry. And I don't know, you know, I was obviously here in 2012 for that series, but I just don't feel the hate coming off the ice so much this time around. And I think if the teams obviously have different identities, I think one thing Mike Sullivan has really tried to do is sort of tamp down that side of the game from the Penguins' perspective, and his motto obviously is just play. And so I think that goes into sort of trying to you know, not get into the extracurriculars and the personal grudges and that sort of thing. And I think Crosby has sort of bought into that too. And obviously, you know, he's 6 years older now than he was. He's 30 as opposed to 24 playing in a playoff series. So I think he's a little bit more mature too. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, what matters most to Crosby is coming away with a series victory. And you know, any sort of personal rivalry that may or may not exist with Giroux or anyone on the Flyers, honestly, Crosby's just happiest if they're moving on to the next round and the other team's going home.
Last question for you, Sam. Derek Brassard missed a lot of time towards the end of the year with injuries. Obviously played all the playoff games so far for the Penguins, and you know, he's got a couple points in the playoffs so far. How would you assess his performance? He was the big, of course, trade deadline acquisition for Jim Rutherford, or by Jim Rutherford and for the Penguins.
Yeah, I think Brassard's taken a little bit of time to sort of work back in. The first, I'd say, two playoff games, he seemed to still sort of be getting his legs back under him after missing that time at the end of the season. And Sullivan talked about that, and especially for a guy coming over at the trade deadline. Those, you know, it was only five games, but that's five critical games that he didn't get to sort of mesh with his new teammates there at the end of the year. And since then, I think he's been pretty good. The third line these last few games of him, Connor Sherry, and Brian Rust, I thought last night that might have been the Penguins' best line, just in terms of creating chances, getting shots, and Rust obviously gets the goal. So that line has looked pretty good for them, and Brassard was really good in the middle of it. The thing I'm interested in moving forward, assuming the Penguins can close this series out either tomorrow or in Game 7 next week, is whether or not we see a revival of the Phil Kessel-Derek Brassard experiment on the third line. I think the Penguins probably feel like they're at their best if they can put Kessel on that third line, but him and Brassard really haven't clicked to any meaningful degree since Brassard has come over at the trade deadline. So it'll be interesting if they try that again, or if they just sort of maybe admit defeat there and keep Kessel with Malkin on the second line and go with speed guys like Rust and Sherry around Brassard on the third.
Sam Werner covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The crucial Game 6 between the Penguins and the Flyers goes tomorrow afternoon in Philadelphia. Sam, thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate your insight.
Absolutely. Anytime, guys.
Take care, Sam. When we come back, we're going to look at the Western Conference playoff series that have been completed, do a post-mortem on both the Anaheim Ducks and the Los Angeles Kings, a grand total of zero playoff victories for those two teams. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
It says a lot. Those were the three teams that really personified heavy hockey, so to speak, with St. Louis, Anaheim, and Los Angeles. So I would say the answer is probably yes. But the smart teams that have been transitioning their roster for the last few years, realizing there was a trend happening and knowing the players that were coming through the pipeline and the way the league was calling the game, those teams saw this coming two or three years ago.
Insider Pierre McGuire talking about the quote-unquote death of heavy hockey. The St. Louis Blues obviously missed the playoffs this year. They're a heavy team. The LA Kings and the Anaheim Ducks, two heavy teams as well. Both of them get swept out in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, losing in four straight games to the San Jose Sharks and the Vegas Golden Knights, respectively. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're live on TSN 1290. This segment is brought to you by our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey, and proud sponsor of the hashtag ICOT pool. Anytime a game goes into overtime during the Stanley Cup playoffs, be sure to send your one selection to both us and at Rumors Comedy on Twitter. If you select wisely and select correctly, you can win tickets to see a great upcoming comedian at Rumors Comedy Club. For more information, rumorscomedyclub.com. We actually need more overtime games. It's been very quiet when it comes to the ICOT
pool. Four overtime games,
yeah,
right?
Last year there's something like 18 in the first round.
Crazy.
So very quiet so far with the ICOT pool. Hopefully that will pick up as the playoff series go on and as the second round begins next week.
Four overtimes, Drew, and three of them coming in the Capitals-Blue Jackets series, right? The other one coming in the Vegas-LA series, which we're going to talk about here, obviously. But yeah. I agree. Last year in the Toronto-Washington series, you had, what was it, five just in that series?
Yeah, it was crazy last year. This year it's completely different in terms of the overtimes. So let's get back to Pierre Maguire's comments. He says that, you know, the heavy hockey game is dead. Would you agree with that? Is this the end of heavy hockey, or is it more accurately the end of heavy, slow-footed hockey?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to say that. I think, you know, saying heavy hockey, that's just a label. Right? And as far as I'm concerned, the Jets play heavy hockey, but they're fast. I don't think they have to be exclusive. That's my point. I mean, the Jets have some big bodies that can crash and bang. We know who those guys are, right? Buff, Lowry, Brandon Tanev, Ben Chiarot when Matt Hendricks is in the lineup. Obviously, you know, Buff and Lowry and Tanev are, you know, the guys that lead the Jets in hits. But I don't think you have to be one or the other. Do you know what I mean by that? And so for the Kings, you know, they're obviously a team that has been known over the years, you know, winning those two Stanley Cups, being great defensive teams, and having, like, you know, big kind of lumbering players. You remember back to their Stanley Cup teams when they had guys like Robin Regier, right? And they had grinders like Kyle Clifford and Trevor Lewis. And, you know, the Kings, I think, just didn't get the goal scoring. I mean, to me, it's not because they haven't transitioned from this heavy hockey team. I just don't think that they were getting enough goal scoring. And, you know, Anze Kopitar, Dustin Brown, Jeff Carter, they can't do it all. You know, we heard that Jeff Carter was not 100%. He definitely was not at full health. But as far as I'm concerned, I mean, look at the games. The majority of these games in the series were one-goal games.
They scored a grand total of three games in the four series. I mean, you know, Kopitar had 2 points. Iafolo had one goal, and Paul Ledoux had one goal. That was the extent of the goal scoring for the Los Angeles Kings.
No, not most of the games. They were actually all one-goal games.
Yeah.
I mean, the first game was 1-0. Second game went to overtime, 2-1. I mean, the last game was a 1-0 game. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, guys like Tyler Toffoli, Tanner Pearson, Adrian Kempe, who's obviously a rookie, they needed more run support for Jonathan Quick. Whoa. We talked about it on Wednesday's show. Jonathan Quick puts up a .947 save percentage in four games, and they don't win a single game. He stopped almost 95% of the shots.
It's a flawed roster. And I think for whatever reason, people maybe overlooked that it was a flawed roster.
Well, they missed Doughty in game two.
Yeah.
Game two, Doughty was suspended.
Yeah.
And it, you know, goes to double overtime. They could have definitely used him. He would have probably played 75 minutes that game.
Yeah. You're not wrong. I mean, obviously, they would have relied on him. The Kings just couldn't get anything going. And they continue to be a flawed roster. I mean, they have Kopitar, Doughty, and Quick. And those are three great players to build around. But after that, I mean, Jeff Carter, who was a shell of himself this year because of injury.
Yep.
And after that, there's just nobody there that really moves the needle very much. I mean, Alec Martinez is a nice defenseman, and Jake Muzzin is a nice defenseman. But if you have nobody who can put the puck in the net, in this, the way the game is being called right now, you need to have offense. You just can't survive without offense. And the LA Kings just have nothing whatsoever. You can have the best defensive system in the world, and they have a pretty damn good defensive system. But with no offense, you have no chance whatsoever, Dave.
No, and both LA and Anaheim were the lowest scoring teams in the playoffs in the Western Conference. And there's a reason what, you know, when you can't score goals and you can't win the game. So regardless of how good your goaltender is, as we saw. And you know what? I have to say, like, that because it was a late series, I happened to watch, you know, a lot of the LA and Vegas.
Night owl.
Yeah. And so to me, that was a really exciting, it was really exciting for Vegas, obviously, to get their first series win. And it was also, it was just an exciting, it was exciting hockey. It was fast. It was actually pretty entertaining, even though it was low scoring. But to me, it was on your, you know, a little bit on your edge when you're not really, you don't really watch a lot of the Pacific teams as much as, you know, we do with the Central. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, it was pretty entertaining, and you could see that there's a little bit of a rivalry. The, you know, the fans were invading the respective buildings. So to me, that was like a lot of fun. But again, you know, it comes down to goal scoring, and it was clear to me that LA just didn't have the horses to get it done.
Yeah, and I think going back to, you know, what Pierre Maguire was saying there, you know, and I think he's referencing players like Dustin Brown. We know he's a physical player, and Dion Phaneuf. I think Dion Phaneuf looked horrible in the first round series. And, you know, for me, I mean,
slow.
I think a player like Evander Kane would look great on this Kings roster. They needed a player like that. They needed a driver, a forward that has that ability, you know, to move in straight lines. And
Well, you know, look how good he was for San Jose in that first round against the Anaheim Ducks.
Right, and you know I think the Kings have tried to get quicker. You know, over the years prior to the trade deadline, they acquired a guy like Toby Reeder. Toby Reeder's a good player. He's a free agent. I wouldn't be surprised if the Kings re-sign him. But when you're talking about, you know, some of the players that have come into their lineup this year, rookies, you know, Adrian Kempe, he's got some speed. Alex Iafallo, he was on the top line at times this year. And, you know, I think they do have players that play with that speed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, when you match them up against a team like the Vegas Golden Knights, I mean, sure, they look slow out there. And the Kings look slow when we saw them here in Winnipeg. So I think that's something that, you know, Rob Blake is going to have to look at here in the offseason. But just to say, you know, that the Kings haven't transitioned from a heavy team, I think is oversimplifying it.
The good news for the Los Angeles Kings, of course, is Drew Doughty becomes an unrestricted free agent after next season. He's eligible to sign a contract extension on July 1st with the Kings, given that it's 1 year before you hit unrestricted free agency. On Friday, Drew Doughty, after the season ended, said, quote, "I always wanted to be an L.A. King, and I want to stay an L.A. King. I can't remember what day we can start talking, but I'm sure we will when the time comes." So, I mean, because if the L.A. Kings were to lose Drew Doughty, I mean, you might as well, you have to tear the whole thing down entirely.
Is Drew Doughty not a massive bargain right now at $7 million?
Sure, he's not going to. He'll get double digits with his next contract.
I mean, I've been saying this for years, and I remember when Richie was on the show. You know, he shared my opinion. I mean, I think Drew Doughty is the best defenseman, best overall defenseman in the league. And as far as I'm concerned, he should get upwards of $12 million a year.
He's that impactful. I mean, can you imagine this LA Kings team without Drew Doughty? I mean, they'd be one of the worst teams in the league.
He plays half the game. He plays in all situations. Mm-hmm. You know, he is, if he's not the best defenseman, he's a top three defenseman in the league, and he was nominated for the Norris Trophy again. You know, it's unfortunate they didn't have him in Game 2. I think if he plays in Game 2, guys, I really think the series is different. I'm not necessarily saying the Kings win it, but I definitely don't think they get swept there.
Moving to Anaheim, they also got swept by the San Jose Sharks, and that has to be even more dispiriting than what the LA Kings experienced, because the Kings have flaws on the roster, and everybody knew that. I mean, the Kings are such a top-heavy team with Doughty and Quick and Kopitar. You look at the Anaheim Ducks roster. They were basically the
I don't know what happened there.
They were the roster that they wanted to be entering the playoffs.
I'm much more surprised, Drew, that the Ducks got swept by the Sharks. That's because of how the Ducks finished the season.
Well, they
right?
they overcame the San Jose Sharks to get home ice advantage.
Right.
And we talked about this briefly on Wednesday's NHL This Week show, Ezzy. You lose 8-1.
I can't explain that.
And I mean, it looked like something was rotten to the core. When you lose 8-1 in the Stanley Cup Finals and you don't have any what I'm going to call injury excuses. I mean, I know the Wild lost 5-0 last night, but they have injury excuses. The Ducks were without Cam Fowler, so that's significant. But when you go up the middle with Getzlaff and Kessler and Henrique, and you lose 8-1, that's an effort issue. That's a morale issue. That's a spirit issue. And the Anaheim Ducks were just absolutely blown out of the water by the San Jose Sharks, and you wonder if that's another flawed roster going forward, given that they've paid these aging veterans for a lot of years still to come.
Yeah, sure, Drew, but you can say any team that gets knocked out in the first round and swept, you're going to say it's a flawed roster, right? And I'm not saying that you're not bringing up a good point.
The only team I wouldn't have this year, if the Colorado Avalanche had been swept by the Nashville Predators, I would have said, okay, that's reasonable. I mean, they...
But it's still a flawed roster. I mean, that's a top-heavy team.
But it's a flawed roster still on their way up, as opposed to a flawed roster on
right.
their way down.
I know, but we weren't talking about flawed roster on the way up or on the way down. We're talking about right now, right?
Sure.
And so, I mean, same thing goes with the Anaheim Ducks. I mean, they just didn't get the run support, and John Gibson didn't play well. I mean, let's be honest here. You know, John Gibson has been their number one goalie for several years now, and he didn't play well. And everyone's going to be talking about how they miss Cam Fowler, sure. But when you're talking about Getzlaff, Kessler, Corey Perry,
yeah.
Zero goals.
Can't win.
4 games, 0 goals for those three right there.
Yeah. You have no chance.
From the analysis that I've been reading and from the little bit of that
Adam Henrique,
that
by the way, also didn't score in that
series. That I was able to watch, it sounds like there were a lot of shenanigans. And I think that's... The Ducks were attempting to get the Sharks off their game, and it just didn't seem to work. And it seemed like it was a lot of extracurriculars that, you know, sometimes happens. And as a result, you know, you think you're going to, you know, you've come with a game plan, but it doesn't work. And the Sharks were able to ignore and just continue to persevere.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the Capitals Blue Jackets series. That's been evened at 2 games apiece, with the Capitals winning both games in Columbus. Isabel Kershedian of the Washington Post joins us next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number 3 of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mindell, Dave Minuke, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. Producer Rory working his magic behind the board. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. If you want to see some great photography from both inside Bell MTS Place and last night's runway party outside the arena, check us out on Instagram. Just search for Illegal Curve. You'll find us there. And of course, our website that's got the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Washington Post, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Isabel Kershedian. She covers the Capitals and the Capitals Blue Jackets series. Isabel, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure. It's now a 2-2 series after the visiting team has won both games in their respective opponent's barn. Game 5 going back to Washington. You know, Isabel, when the Capitals went to Columbus down 2-0, did you think that this team, you know, still had it in them, given their playoff adversity and their playoff struggles for so many years? Did you expect that this series to come back to Washington with a 2-2 tie?
I certainly knew it was possible. I mean, they play pretty well when their backs are against the wall, or especially in the first round. I know they've had issues, you know, historically in the second round, but in the first round, they do seem to have a certain confidence, and it's kind of Columbus who has that history with, you know, the first round, that they haven't ever won a playoff series. So I think, you know, with the Capitals, I didn't know that they would do it, but I thought it was certainly possible. They're not a team that goes quietly into the night.
Isabel, we have to ask you right off the bat about Braden Holtby. He doesn't start the first 2 games, and then the last 2 games, both victories, he only allows 3 goals. Just how impressive has Holtby been in this series, considering that it must have been tough for him to watch that first game and second game from the bench?
Yeah, he handled it really well, I thought. He was a good teammate to Grubauer, and, you know, he never, what I thought stood out to me at least, was that he never panicked. It was never this, you know, he never acted like he completely had lost his game, because I don't think he really had. I think there were a few things that he had gotten away from, or he just looked a little off, but it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, one day he was going to start goaltender, and the next day, you know, he deserved to be playing the AHL. I mean, he was still a good goalie, and I think he knew that, and, you know, he's someone who believes in kind of earning your playing time, and he never had earned it. And I think he understood that. And now, you know, to me, Holtby's never looked more confident than he does right now, which is pretty amazing considering how this whole thing went down.
You know, Isabel, Alexander Ovechkin vowed that the series would return to Washington tied 2-2. How significant was that vow to his teammates? And also, did you notice it in his play in games 3 and 4?
Yeah, I don't know if that really, if guys in the locker room, like, pay too much attention to that, but I know that other players kind of felt the same way, even if, you know, they didn't voice it in the form of a guarantee like Ovechkin did. I think the Caps, like I said, they're a confident team, and they went to Columbus thinking, okay, the only way we're going to win this series is if we, you know, win both games here and tie it. Otherwise, you know, they didn't really stand a chance, I don't think, come back from like a 3-1 or a 3-0 hole. So, you know, I think they felt that, and Ovi's just the one who always seems to kind of say those things and be the vocal guy. But I do think he showed it, certainly in game 4, where, you know, I thought he was playing really well, and then he scores that goal in the third period. That's the first, you know, 3-0 lead they have. So, you know, he's made these guarantees before. They haven't always worked out. This time, he made sure to back it up.
Isabel Kershedian is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about the Capitals Blue Jackets series. that series is tied at 2 games apiece. Game 5 goes this afternoon back in Washington. Isabel, Artemi Panarin was absolutely dominant through the first 3 games of the series with 7 points in those 3 games. Game 4 featured the Capitals really focusing on him and keying on him by dropping into a neutral zone trap that eliminated his time and space. You know, how much of a key is that continued stifling of Artemi Panarin for the Capitals' chances to end up winning this series?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I mean, he's clearly like, I mean, I had seen him before, but he's never stood out to me so much as in this series. When they went to double overtime, it seemed like he was always on the ice because just when he was on, your eyes were just sort of drawn to him. He was always coming up the wing with that puck, and you're like, oh, it's over. Like, I think he's played fantastic. So that they were able to contain him at all, I think, is pretty huge. And now, you know, Tortorella's going to make his own kind of adjustments. It's, you know, the game within the game, right? It becomes like this chess match between coaches. And I'm sure Columbus will try to do something to kind of work around that trap. But the Caps did a really good job for at least game 4.
Isabel, Washington won game 4 pretty handily, 4-1. Now, obviously, the first 3 games of the series all went to overtime. These two teams, does it just show you how evenly matched these two teams, starting with how good their number one goalies are?
Yeah, absolutely. And Columbus came into the playoffs really hot. I think they had won like 13 of their last 16 games or something like that. So they've been playing, you know, incredibly well. And the Caps had been, I thought, had been playing some of their better hockey toward the end of the season. I thought the Caps were the better team in game 2. Which they lost, but then Bobrovsky made like 54 saves. Then you go to game 3, and maybe Columbus was the better team there, but Braden Holtby looked, you know, really solid. So it is, goaltending's kind of making it even closer, but I think it was going to be close to begin with.
Isabel, how big a loss is Andrei Burakovsky's injury? And you know, Coach Trotz said that it was a minor, he's going to require minor surgery, but which is shocking usually with respect to the cone of silence that covers most injuries. But do you think he's going to be gone for longer than perhaps just the first round if the Capitals make it past?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how long he'd be out, but I imagine it would be probably the first 2 rounds if they advance, at least, right? Like any sort of minor procedure, no matter what it is, it does take time. As far as how big of a loss, I mean, they're used to playing without him. He missed 20 games earlier this year. I mean, I think it's a blow to their top six because he does have some nice skill and speed to go with, you know, Nicholas Backstrom and TJ Oshie. And now they're kind of having to, like, figure out who works best there. They have Chandler Stephenson there right now because he does have some of that same speed, but he's also kind of a two-way, responsible guy, but he's not someone who has, you know, a ton of point production. I think he's a versatile piece, but, you know, typically he'd be like a bottom six forward for you. Then you've got, you know, Jacob Verana, the rookie, who's probably most similar to Burakovsky as far as, you know, being able to shoot it, but he's kind of a risk this time of year because of his, you know, his play can be unreliable in the defensive zone. So, you know, they have a few kind of questions there. I think right now it's going to be Stephenson, and he's played well there the past couple of games, but I think it's a loss. It's not a devastating one.
Isabel Kershedian, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, talking about the Capitals Blue Jackets series, game 5 this afternoon back in Washington. Isabel, Tom Wilson was a bit of a liability for the first 2 games of this series, you know, taking some undisciplined penalties, not really doing much on the score sheet. The last 2 games have been much more impactful, getting 3 points in the last 2 games, a penalty in each game as well, unfortunately, I guess. But do you see Tom Wilson more settling into the series after the struggles of the first 2 games?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's been a really steady player for them all year, and honestly one of their best players, just how he's kind of fit on that top line, how he's evolved his game. I think he's been a very important piece for them to making this work, because it sort of balances out their top six to have him up there. And, you know, he's been kind of a smarter hockey player all around. So to see him take those penalties in those situations, you know, it felt like, you know, old Tom Wilson, right, where he was going to the box all the time. And, you know, for those of us who have seen him all year, you know, it was a little out of character for this season. But now he's doing kind of what you expect him to do. He's not afraid to shoot it, even though he's got a veteran on the other side of him on that line. He goes to the net. He makes a difference with kind of his physicality, and especially when they're playing a little bit of a lighter line when it's Dubois, Panarin, and Atkinson. You know, Ovechkin and Wilson should kind of use their strengths against those guys. So I think, you know, these last two games are much more what we expect of him. Yeah, he's good to penalties sometimes. That's just kind of the way he plays. But it's the situation, the time, you know, when the team is down with a goal, don't go for, you know, kind of a hit that is maybe unnecessary, those kind of things.
Isabel, wanted to ask you about Christian Juice. He didn't play the first two games for the Capitals, but he's replaced Jacob Jerebek in the lineup. The Capitals have obviously won those two games. What element has he brought to that back end that Barry Trotz is loving so much right now?
Yeah, the guy's just like a breakout machine. He's very poised and kind of has a nice skill set, and he just reminds me of like Baxter. But as a defenseman, where you have this patience and this vision, and it helps on breakouts, obviously, but it just seems like whenever he's on the ice, he has the puck. So, you know, I think that's what they like about him, is that even though he's a rookie, he plays with a certain presence, and he's able to kind of account for maybe his lack of size. He's a smaller guy, you know, at 6'1", 170. But he's able to account for that, which sort of is smart, if that makes sense.
Isabel Kershedian covers the Washington Capitals for the Washington Post. Game 5 between the Capitals and the Blue Jackets goes later on this afternoon.
So, Isabel, we're going to obviously see overtime this afternoon, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect so. At least it's a day game, though, so I'm fine with some overtime tonight.
There you go. You don't have the deadline won't be rapidly approaching unless it goes really,
exactly.
Really long. Isabel, thank you. Enjoy tonight's, enjoy this afternoon's Game 5.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care. When we come back, we'll look at the Eastern Conference playoff matchups. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Much get to you, because, I mean, then it's just going to be affect you worse.
Just need to stay with it. Maybe we can be better, like I said. You know, this is the time where everybody needs to dig in. Down 3-1, but got a lot of belief in this room.
I thought we did tons of good things last night. We didn't give up very much. We made mistakes on a couple 2-on-1s, and it didn't go our way. But
Toronto Maple Leafs, Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, Rory, is that who we had there? And Mike Babcock as well, talking prior to Game 5 of the Leafs-Bruins series. That goes tonight. We'll talk about that this segment. We'll also talk about the Devils and the Lightning. Game 5 in that series goes this afternoon as well, because somehow the NHL thought it'd be advisable to schedule two games for the exact same time on a Saturday afternoon. So the Lightning and the Devils and the Blue Jackets and the Capitals play, both start at 2:00 Central Time.
Up against Moose versus Griffins.
Moose versus Griffins. Sorry, I thought you meant on TV. That game is not televised.
That's why they're making a huge error.
Right. The Moose and Griffins, obviously, priority number one for hockey fans here in Winnipeg. And for us at Illegal Curve, you can follow all of our Moose coverage on illegalcurve.com. But somehow the NHL decides to start two games at the exact same time, which is mind-boggling in its stupidity. But that's the NHL, oftentimes, in a nutshell. The Lightning and the Devils, as it's a 3-1 Lightning lead after they won a very spirited, I would suggest, Game 4 that took place on Wednesday while we were on air with NHL This Week. And we were expecting that there might be some supplemental discipline in that with Nikita Kucherov's hit that he threw early in the period. And Brian Boyle laid a big body check as well. No supplemental discipline coming out of the game. A little surprised, but I think the hate in that series has begun to elevate as the Lightning now take that 3-1 commanding lead.
Yeah, it was a penalty-filled first period there between the Devils and the Lightning, and, you know, that's a pretty crushing defeat there in Game 4. And, you know, I think Corey Schneider's done an excellent job coming in relief of Keith Kincaid. Keith Kincaid really struggled the first two games, as you know, Drew, and, you know, Schneider was excellent in that Game 3 win. But, I mean, right now, I mean, if Taylor Hall is not putting the puck in the net, the Devils are really struggling to get secondary offense. They got secondary offense in that Game 3 victory. And, you know, Kyle Palmieri's been really good. But, you know, I just think the Devils are overmatched. And I agree. I mean, maybe Nikita Kucherov, you know, gets a suspension there, maybe one game or a fine. But, I mean, when you're talking with the Lightning, they just have so much depth. I mean, Tyler Johnson goes out of the lineup. Matthew Pekka moves on to his line. I mean, Alex Killorn moves up a spot, right? They just have so much depth. And, you know, if one or two guys are out of the lineup, you know, it just doesn't really affect them. Andre Palat, Drew, is a guy who missed a significant amount of time during the regular season. I think he's been really good.
Yes, he's been terrific for the Devils, for the Lightning in this series.
Right, and so, I mean, you just have so many different weapons there. I think Ryan McDonagh, you know, has just made a really good defense even better. I think the Devils are just having trouble really penetrating and getting a lot of looks at the middle part of the ice, and a lot of the shots are coming from the outside. Andre Vasilevsky sees it. He's going to stop it. So I think Andre Vasilevsky has outplayed, you know, Kincaid and Schneider, even though, as I mentioned, Schneider was really good in Game 3 and he was really good in Game 4. But if the Devils have any chance at extending the series, I mean, they're just going to have to get more offense. And, you know, Taylor Hall has been really good, as he has been all year. But
It's just a one-sided, I mean, on paper, it's the David and Goliath matchup, like you were saying before about the Predators and the Avalanche. It's almost the Eastern Conference version of that. Sammy Vatanen, Devils defenseman, is a game-time decision for the Devils after he took that hit from Kucherov in Game 4, where he left the game, did not practice Thursday, and did not travel with the team to Tampa Bay, but he might travel on his own.
Usually not a good sign.
Not a good sign if you're not on the plane with the team.
Not many guys are going to choose to go commercial.
Generally not. And if you think that he has got a chance of playing, you probably bring him with the team. But not a good sign for the Devils. And without Sammy Vatanen, who came over, of course, from the Anaheim Ducks earlier in the year, that defense, which, you know, isn't especially deep to begin with, looks even thinner without Vatanen in the lineup against the juggernaut Lightning offense.
Let's be realistic. If David Putty can't get this Devils team fired up,
they were fired up.
Well, fired up enough to win, then they have nothing in the tank and they just don't have it, because David Putty, you know, he's a Devil.
He is the Devil.
You got to support the team.
But to their credit, they've really embraced it. I mean, you have to give the Devils credit for organization for doing that, because sometimes during the playoffs, especially, a team may not want to, you know, be lighthearted in that regard, and they've embraced the David Putty aspect, had him in, he face painted, had the D on his chest, got the team fired up, and they used the video. I mean, someone showed a video, I saw a video on Twitter, they were showing the scoreboard where they used David Putty to fire up the crowd, so they have a lot of fun with it. I mean, you know, this is a team that's kind of wasn't expected to do much against Tampa Bay, and you know, we're seeing really what many of us expected, which was Tampa Bay easily handling a Devils team that's, you know, doesn't have a tremendous amount of playoff experience.
Well, and Nikita Kucherov has been an absolute beast in this series. I mean, he was terrific all regular season long, and then he sort of slowed up towards the end of the year. He wasn't quite as good, which, I mean, makes sense given that the Devils really had clinched, you know, first in the Atlantic Division back in January. I mean, I guess the Bruins made a good run at it, but they clinched a playoff spot so early on that Kucherov took his foot off the gas, but he's really been able to flip that switch for the start of the playoffs. He's got 9 points in his first 4 games, and he's just been the best player for the Tampa Bay Lightning, and the Devils have had no answer for him, which explains really why the Lightning are up 3-1 to some extent right now, Ezzy.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, we talked about it before, but you know, half of the Devils' goals have come in that Game 3 victory, right?
Yeah.
5 of the 11 goals, so almost half. And you know, the Devils got a big boost with Marcus Johansson returning to the lineup. But he just hasn't been as effective, I think, as John Hines would like him to be, right?
Yeah, two concussions this year?
I mean, that's right.
Yeah, it's hard to be that good when you've had that many concussions in one season.
Right, so, you know, it goes back to the depth, and, you know, that's at all positions. I think maybe, you know, the goaltending is probably the closest area for these two teams, but, I mean, the Lightning, we know how good they've been all year long, and they were a heavy favorite in this series. We'll see if the Devils are able to extend the series here, but, you know, it's going to be a big task.
The other Eastern Conference playoff series that we haven't yet spoken about this year is, of course, the Bruins and the Leafs. They go to Boston tonight for Game 5, where the Bruins look to clinch on home ice. A huge missed opportunity for the Toronto Maple Leafs in Game 4, with no Patrice Bergeron in the lineup for the Bruins, and the Leafs can't take advantage of it. The Bruins, you know, don't miss a beat, and they have that huge victory to take that 3-1 stranglehold, and it looks like the Leafs are going to be golfing sooner rather than later, the way the Bruins have really dominated the majority of that series.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and, you know, Nazem Kadri is going to come back into the lineup tonight, Drew, and you know they're going to get a boost with having Kadri there. But you're right. I mean, no Patrice Bergeron, but David Pastrnak.
He's expected to play, for the record, tonight. Bruce Cassidy, Bruins head coach, came out and said after missing Game 4, they expect Bergeron to be back in the lineup tonight for Game 5.
Yeah, and you know obviously that just makes it even worse for the Leafs. But you know, a player for me that's been really impressive is Jake DeBrusk. And he was kind of a controversial pick when the Bruins took him with one of those picks at the draft in 2015.
Where they passed over Kyle Connor to take DeBrusk.
And Jake DeBrusk has been excellent on that second line. And David Krejci has been excellent centering that second line. So the Bruins, you know, similar to the Lightning, have so much depth. And I think, you know, the Leafs drawing the Bruins in the first round was a horrible matchup. And, you know, Freddie Anderson, I thought, was better you know, in Game 4, and, you know, I just don't think that he's been the same Freddie Anderson that we saw during the regular season, but, you know, the defensive coverage has been awful. I mean, I don't think, you know, I think, you know, the, if you look at the goals that were scored against the Leafs, I mean, they were the result of turnovers, you know, Jake Gardner, Nikita Zaitsev pinching in at the blue line, and, you know, the Bruins are the type of team, if you give them their opportunity, especially, you know, odd man rushes, they're going to bury it. We saw that on Jake DeBrusk's goal, and, you know, he's been really good in the series. But, again, it's kind of similar to the Lightning and the Devils. I just think offensively the Bruins are too much for the Leafs, and they just look a little bit lost at times in their defensive zone.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the glaring weakness for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and you wondered how it was going to affect them before the series, Dave. But the Leafs' defense has just looked discombobulated all series long, and, I mean, if the offseason comes soon for the Leafs, and it looks like that's going to be the case, you know what the offseason priority is for the Toronto Maple Leafs. You can't start another season with the holes they have on their back end. Just guys like Nikita Zaitsev has had a horrible year. Roman Polak is getting up there in age, and he doesn't have the foot speed necessary. Travis Dermott's a young player, a nice young player. Jake Gardner is... You know what you're getting with Jake Gardner. He's you know, a defensive liability. He's got some offensive skill, but he just, you know, gives it back in his own zone oftentimes. They're just warts on the Leafs' back end that are being exposed by the Bruins so far through four games.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is the Bruins are one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference, and they're showing it. And I really think Toronto, while having a good young roster, doesn't even come close to what the Bruins are. So, I mean, this is, again, and we've been saying this a lot because I think it's true, it's a David and Goliath situation where really you're just kind of waiting for the second round to watch, you know, the Bruins and Lightning, because that to me is like the series that you're going to, like that to me, those are the two best teams in the Eastern Conference going to go at it. And I think we're going to see that a lot in the second round where, you know, these are the games that you really kind of want it, which we were hoping for maybe a third round as opposed to the second round. That's just the way the NHL is. Mm-hmm. It's the way the playoff format is, unfortunately. But I mean, this Bruins team has been lights out, and it's one of these teams that I it's very unusual because everyone wants to talk about Pittsburgh going for the three-peat, and everyone talks about Tampa Bay because they're so high-powered and they were, you know, so successful throughout the year, but nobody seems to be talking about the Bruins. And to me, they are one of the deepest teams in the NHL. So I think that they're probably, they would be my pick right now to come out of the East. I could be wrong, but I think that they have as good a chance as anybody to be a Stanley Cup finalist.
I think to your point there, I think the Bruins have blossomed. I mean, some people maybe had them as a playoff team, but they were more of a fringe playoff team as opposed to an upper echelon Eastern Conference team, Ezzy. I think the Bruins have blossomed with some of their young players and incorporated their young players with their veterans better than anybody would have expected this season in what I think a lot of people thought would be a transition year. Bruce Cassidy behind the bench, his first full season as Bruins head coach. I think people thought this might be a transition year to get some more experience for their younger players, but those younger players have stepped up, I think, beyond the wildest dreams of Bruins fans and Bruins management.
Yeah, I agree. And further to Dave's point, I think the first round has been pretty disappointing. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about from a Winnipeg Jets perspective. I'm talking about a big picture perspective here. You know, the Sharks series between the Sharks and the Ducks was disappointing. The Kings series between the Kings and the Golden Knights was very disappointing. And, you know, I'm much more looking forward to the second round coming up. We're going to see some great series.
Especially in the Western Conference, where the upper echelon teams really separated themselves from their weaker opponents. As you can see, with two sweeps, a Game 5 victory, and then whatever's going to happen still in the Avalanche-Predators series.
But every second round series is setting up to be phenomenal.
Right.
So, I mean, you look at that and you're thinking to yourself, okay, finish the first round quickly, hurry up, because everybody just wants to watch the second round.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. When we come back, we talk about Bill Peters resigning as head coach of the Carolina Hurricanes. We talk about the fact he's likely to be the Flames' new head coach. We talk about who's going to end up in Carolina. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of hour number three. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Quick programming note for you. Tuesday evening is going to be NHL this week, next week. You got that? So Tuesday evening for NHL this week with Illegal Curve Hockey. Wednesday, we're going to have the Moose Grand Rapids Griffins Game 3. So we're going to be on Tuesday evening. We'll likely, hopefully, be able to preview the Jets' second-round matchup against, well, either the Nashville Predators if they win Game 6, or they'll be watching Game 7 closely, which will also happen on Tuesday night. In any event, set your calendars, you know, set your timers, put it in your... put it in your day timer if you still carry a day timer. Tuesday evening, 6 p.m., NHL this week here on TSN 1290. And, of course, the Moose and Grand Rapids Griffins puck drop on that first game of their best-of-five playoff series goes this afternoon at Bell MTS Place. We're going to be joined by Mitch Peacock in about 10 minutes' time, Manitoba Moose play-by-play voice broadcaster. He's going to join us to preview the Moose and the Grand Rapids Griffins, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290, coming up with pregame show at 1:45 this afternoon. Ezzie Bill Peters, no longer the head coach of the Carolina Hurricanes, he elects to use his opt-out clause. There's a bit of a game of chicken going on between Bill Peters and Tom Dundon, the new owner of the Carolina Hurricanes. It was clear that Dundon did not want Bill Peters back behind the bench. He's going to go in a different direction. But they were sort of doing a chicken, and they were playing chicken with each other to see if Dundon was going to have to fire Peters or if Peters would resign and use the opt-out clause. It seems more than likely, nothing officially announced yet, but barring something unforeseen, Bill Peters will likely head to Calgary to be their new head coach. And you know, according to TSN hockey insider Bob McKenzie, there's a lot of interested parties who want to talk to Bill Peters or are interested in acquiring his services behind the bench. Are you surprised that a guy who had so little success in Carolina is such a hot commodity in the coaching realm in the NHL?
No, I'm not surprised, Drew. And, you know, Bill Peters is an excellent hockey coach. And I think, you know, in the 4 years he was head coach of the Hurricanes, he unfortunately didn't get them into the playoffs. But, you know, just, you know, when you think about Calgary, I think he's a really good fit there, and I think we're expecting him to be named the next head coach of the Flames. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, this year they didn't get the goaltending, and that's been an issue for the Hurricanes for not just, you know, the last year, but the last several years. And I actually like the direction the Hurricanes are going there, and, you know, they still need a GM as well, right? And, sure, you know, Ron Francis has moved to that position of president of hockey operations, yeah, but...
Demoted upwards is basically what that was.
So, I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see who the Hurricanes go with as well for their next head coach. And, you know, Alain Vigneault's in the conversation there. I think there are a lot of coaches, especially coaches that were on the sidelines without a head coaching job this year. I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if you know, the Carolina Hurricanes maybe bring in, you know, a familiar face. But all indications are that Peters is going to be head coach of the Calgary Flames based on his previous relationship with Brad Tree Living. But, you know, just because, you know, the Hurricanes weren't able to get into the playoffs, I don't think, you know, that that all falls on Bill Peters. I do think that, you know, the Hurricanes did fail to, you know, bring in the right players. And, you know, Scott Darling is one of them. But, you know, I do think that the Hurricanes over the years have struggled with secondary scoring. And, you know, they did address that partially by bringing in guys like, you know, Teuvo Teravainen. But, you know, again, for Bill Peters, I mean, he's definitely going to get a head coaching job here very soon.
The nice thing for him also is that he gets a little bit more of an experienced roster, and a roster that, well, similar to Carolina in that there's expectations that they were going to be a playoff team, you know, but Calgary even more so, I think. And, you know, Bill Peters is from an hour and a half north of Calgary, so for him, it's nice to get that opportunity to kind of coach your hometown team, the team that probably grew up supporting. So, for it, like I said, it's a nice opportunity for a local kid to get that chance with the team that he probably grew up cheering for.
Yeah, if he doesn't get better goaltending there in Calgary, though, and Mike Smith was good for a portion of the year before he went down with injury, the Flames obviously need to solidify that backup position, because you can't really rely on Mike Smith to be healthy for an entire season. He's had his injury struggles going back to his days with the Arizona Coyotes. I mean, Bill Peters needs goaltending. The Flames need goaltending. That's the one thing he never had in Carolina, which really, you know, as, hey, look, we see it here in Winnipeg. I mean, you look back now and all the times we thought that the Jets could make do with a patchwork goaltending situation with, you know, guys like Andre Pavlik and whatnot. Obviously, that's proven to be you can't win in the NHL on a regular basis without very good to elite goaltending like the Jets have received with Connor Hellebuck this season.
I also think it's critical in that, especially you can win probably during the regular season, but the truth is when you play a team in a 7-game series, they start to expose those weaknesses a little bit more, and especially when guys are able to figure out what a guy does and his tendencies, you really are focusing all your resources on trying to eliminate or to get to that guy's weakness. So to me, that's where it really becomes exposed in the playoffs. But again, like I said, that of course Calgary has to address that, but a lot of NHL teams need to address that, I think.
The leader in the clubhouse for the Carolina Hurricanes job, Ezzie, is Rod Brind'Amour. Of course, he's currently the assistant coach for the Hurricanes. Never had any head coaching experience before. Was the captain of the Hurricanes. Was a tremendous NHL player for so many years with the Hurricanes and the Flyers. You know, does Rod Brind'Amour, a rookie head coach, make sense to you to replace Bill Peters in Carolina? I mean, Peters, when he took the job, had never been a head coach before. He'd been an assistant coach with the Red Wings for many years under Mike Babcock.
I think you probably want a head coach with a lot of experience. I mean, to me, Alain Vigneault makes a lot of sense for this Hurricanes team. When was the last time the Hurricanes made the playoffs? 2006?
Yeah, it's been over a decade. It's been 12 years since the Hurricanes last had playoff success.
And Rod Brind'Amour was a fantastic hockey player, but, you know, as you mentioned, you know, you don't know what you're going to get there with Rod Brind'Amour as a head coach. And I think he's done an excellent job as an assistant, but I mean, for me, and this is just me, I mean, if I'm Tom Dundon, and it obviously has a lot to do with who they bring in as a general manager, right? I mean, the general manager is going to want to put his guy in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a chance it is Rod Brind'Amour. But for me, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to bring in a coach like Alain Vigneault.
I agree with you. I mean, the thing about bringing in a guy, you never heard Rod Brind'Amour's name, you know, prior to this, as being, you know, one of those hot up-and-coming head coaches or a guy who's been an assistant coach and ready to take that next step. So you wonder what Dundon sees in Brind'Amour. Not to say that Brind'Amour might not be a good head coach. I don't know. But it seems odd that you'd elevate this guy who hadn't really been talked about as head coaching material immediately to take over a team that hasn't had any playoff success, hasn't had the taste of playoffs in over a dozen years.
I think Tom Dundon is showing that he's doing things a little bit differently in Carolina, and he's trying to put a stamp on the team, and you know, perhaps that goes with that sort of idea that he's trying to change what is become the norm in the NHL. So, well, it's yet to see if it's going to have any success. But again, he owns the team; he pays the bills. Yeah. He's entitled to do what he wants.
He gets to have, yeah. He can eat his cake or he can make his cake and eat it too, or whatever along those lines. As we mentioned, the Manitoba Moose start their playoff series this afternoon against the Grand Rapids Griffins. When we come back, Mitch Peacock's going to join us. We'll preview the Moose and the Griffins. It's a 2 p.m. puck drop today at Bell MTS Place. It's a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. Moose Griffins preview up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
One final segment this Saturday morning. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Our website with the latest Jets and Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Live from Bell MTS Place, where he's going to be calling the Manitoba Moose Grand Rapids Griffins Game 1 play of their playoff series. We're joined by Moose broadcaster Mitch Peacock. Mitch, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. How are you?
Doing very well, Mitch. Like I said, appreciate your time on this Saturday morning. The Game 1 between the Moose and the Griffins, this Manitoba Moose team, how do they recapture the form they had earlier in the year? They sort of ended the season on a bit of a down note, 3-7 in the last 10 games. What's it going to take for this Moose team to recapture the magic that saw them atop the AHL standings at various points in the regular season?
Yeah, it's an important question, and I think that in some respects they started on the road to recapturing that over the final three games of the regular season when they won 2 out of 3, a win against Cleveland in very impressive fashion, allowing just 13 shots against, and then a win on the final day of the regular season at Allstate Arena in Chicago against the Wolves. What we saw in those games was a Moose team that was very structured, very disciplined, very organized, that did not allow the other team to get much going in terms of transitioning with pace through neutral ice. and a team that was willing to give up shots, but from outside the dots and from the wide areas, very limited chances in front of the net. That's the way the Moose have to play to be successful. It's a different team than the team that only lost five times in regulation time over the first 29 or 31 games of the regular season, when Jack Roslovic was battling for the league lead in scoring and the team was averaging around four goals a game. I think it's pretty clear to see that when you lose a player like that, a blue chip prospect who's an elite offensive talent, your team has to readjust and play a different way. And that's what the Moose have tried to do over the last months of the season. And I think one of the key elements in their stumbles along the way was that at times they were missing both of their first choice goaltenders, and at other times they had as many as seven players injured. Right now they're as healthy as they've been in a long time, and they know that Eric Comrie will be between the pipes, so they've got some stability in that respect. And the return of Patrice Cormier and Nick Petan in those games last week as well was critical in terms of getting players back into slots where they're best suited and more comfortable and more confident. So I think the margin will be fine for the Moose in this series against Grand Rapids. They're going to have to play their best hockey to have success. It's an excellent opponent, but there's an opportunity here for the team to win three games out of the next five.
Mitch, we know that Sammy Niku is up with the Jets right now, and he obviously didn't play last game, and he's been sent down to the Moose and then recalled. But because Tyler Myers was ready to go for Game 5, Niku didn't play. But is he going to be an option here for the Moose, or are we going to have to wait and see with, you know, the health of Toby Enstrom here?
Well, I'm waiting for something official, but it looks like every indication is that Sammy Niku would be available to the Manitoba Moose for today's game, and obviously that's very important when you're talking about the Defenseman of the Year in the American Hockey League. And Pascal Vincent, philosophically, says that he believes in the spine of a team being the foundation of a team. So you've got to have that good goaltending. You've got to have two or three defensemen at the top of your defense grouping that are able to compete with the other team's best, and then you've got to have strength up the middle in your center icemen. So Niku would be a critical ingredient to the Moose in terms of success here in the playoffs, and it looks like he's going to be playing in the game today, likely alongside Peter Stojkovic.
Mitch, is there any advantage to the Moose having kind of an us-against-the-world mentality? You know, for so long this season, we saw them 133 games, they're in first spot in the Central, and then they've fallen out, and obviously they fell to third. But now, and a lot of people are, you know, looking at Grand Rapids, defending champion, and thinking that they have a clear path to the second round over the Moose. Do you think that's to the advantage of the Manitoba Moose to come in and think that they're a bit of an underdog in the series?
It certainly can't hurt, Dave. I think it's one of those situations where let the other guys have the pressure of expectation. Let the other guys worry about what other people think they're going to do in the first round and how easy it's going to be. The Moose this week have been very structured in what they've done, not just on the ice, but off the ice. Pascal Vincent giving the guys a day of rest on Monday, but on Tuesday, individual meetings. Every player who might be involved in the series with a clear-cut indication of what their assignments and responsibilities are. There was work in practice on specifically how the Moose want to play and how they want to square off with this Grand Rapids team. And I think that they've had a kind of a nice week here where they've been able to do their thing and do what they want to do to feel good about the matchup and feel good about their preparation. So I think in some respects that underdog element is a positive one for the Moose, and they'll take it. I haven't had a chance to pose the question directly, but I got that feeling during the week that they were just going about their business trying to get ready because they feel that it's on them to put their best game forward, and everything else is somebody else's concern.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Manitoba Moose broadcaster Mitch Peacock. The Manitoba Moose and the Grand Rapids Griffins play Game 1 of their first round AHL playoff series this afternoon at Bell MTS Place. A 2 o'clock puck drop. Mitch Peacock with the pregame show beginning at 1:45 here on TSN 1290. Mitch, the Grand Rapids Griffins won 6 of 8 meetings this season against the Moose, including all 4 games at Bell MTS Place. What did the Griffins do that made them so successful against the Moose?
Well, they did what made them successful against virtually everybody, including the playoffs last year when they won the Calder Cup for the second time in a 5-year span. Look, this is an elite opponent. They're deep everywhere. They've got a ton of experience. In the lineup today, my best guess is they've got 14 guys, at least on the roster that they brought in for the game today, 14 guys who got experience with that Calder Cup team of a year ago. So this is a veteran, experienced team with plenty of skill, not only in goal and on defense, but up front. They've got guys who can score. Ben Street leads the way, a terrific playmaker. He's a guy who can set up goals and on a regular basis going into the postseason. He had 44 assists in the regular season. Eric Tangrady, well known in these parts, 91 games with the Jets. He continues to produce, had a 31 goal season, fourth best in the American Hockey League. So this Grand Rapids team is a very good team, and it should surprise no one that they were able to come on as strong as they did after starting out very slowly. You might call it a Calder Cup hangover, but they got over that hangover and how, and they look like a very good team coming in. So I think the Moose will have to be mindful of the high-end players offensively. They'll have to really be disciplined and not spend a lot of time in the penalty box. They'll have to improve on a penalty kill that let them down over the last few weeks of the season. And, of course, in the playoffs, that sort of ace in the hole, the wild card, if you will, is the goaltending. If they can get an edge in the net, then they'll have an opportunity. But it's going to be a challenge. This is an excellent Detroit Red Wings affiliate.
You know, Mitch, you mentioned experience, and we know that the Moose were led offensively this year by rookie Sammy Niku and Mason Appleton, but how much is that AHL playoff experience from guys like Mike Scarbosa and Buddy Robinson going to factor in here to this series?
It's hard to know for sure. It certainly can't hurt. But what we saw with the Winnipeg Jets is that experience doesn't necessarily, it will allow the team to feel a little bit more comfortable, certainly leading into a game like today where you've got those guys around who can say, it's okay, it's just hockey, there's two nets and a puck, we're going to be fine, let's just do the things that we always do and let it work out. So I think it's an element to what the Moose have, and I don't think in any way it could be seen as a negative.
And Mitch, talking about experience and all these young guys who are going to be getting their first taste of AHL or pro hockey experience, what an opportunity for them. You know, Coach Vincent has talked to us about how he gets a chance to, he learns so much in terms of the evaluation of players in a playoff series. So this is such a good opportunity in my mind for a lot of younger players like Appleton, Spacek, Niku, to really kind of show their coach what they're made of in a playoff series as opposed to just the regular season.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think that, you know, it's one of the things that the Jets as an organization were looking at coming into the season. You go all the way back to last offseason, coming off of two non-playoff years in the 2.0 era, coming off of two important years and getting young players a chance to play at this level and getting a chance to understand what the responsibilities are of being a professional. But now coming into this season, a real feeling that, okay, there's been enough progress in the younger group. Let's add in some more experienced players. Let's create a competitive environment, and let's see what it's like to be in a battle for a playoff position. Let's see what it's like to have a chance at maybe even winning the division and then play some playoff hockey, because there's just nothing quite like it. And it's another way to have a look at your players and understand what they're all about, and not only from an evaluation but a development standpoint too. And I think that this is sort of mission accomplished as far as the Winnipeg Jets are concerned, getting this team through the 76 games, getting them in that battle down the stretch, getting them into the postseason, and getting them a chance to play these games here. And of course, the more the better, to get the players that feeling of what the playoffs are all about. So I would say it's a great observation on your part, Dave, and a really important element of what this season is all about for the Jets organization and for the Moose.
Mitch Peacock will have the call of the Moose and the Grand Rapids Griffins, 2 p.m. puck drop at Bell MTS Place. The pregame show starts at 1:45 here on TSN 1290. Mitch, thank you for this.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it. Looking forward to this afternoon.
Enjoy yourself. Have a great call.
Cheers, Mitch.
That's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guests, Keener Jersey, Zappia Group Realty, Bernstein's Deli, Linden Market Dental Center, and Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Support those fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on our website, illegalcurve.com, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Get it sent to you each and every week. For producer Rory doing a great job behind the board, for Dave Minute, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN Radio 1290.
As long as we sit together as a team, we'll be all right.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.